Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Previously on Electric Boogaloo.
What if I served you sardines and dark beer for breakfast?
I wonder if Tyrion's done some kind of crazy reading of a mad maester that has some kind of aphrodisiac. Like, you know, this is Westeros Viagra.
This is Game of Thrones 2 Electric Boogaloo. I'm your host, Anthony. Happy to announce that we will move to a Season 2 for Game of Thrones 2 Electric Boogaloo. And that will probably start in a few weeks. Can't say exactly when. The pod today you're listening to is a reflection on the first 9 chapters, plus some listener feedback with Steve and I. So today we won't be covering a particular chapter. This is an opportunity for you, if you haven't been reading along, to grab that book and read the first 9. It won't take long. And then when we get back together in a few weeks, you'll be all caught up. My guest this week is Gregory Webster. Gregory is a professor of psychology, and he has particular interest in human aggression and human sexuality. So yeah, that's sex and violence, folks, which makes him uniquely qualified to talk about a Game of Thrones. He's taught classes on Game of Thrones, and he's actually incorporated Game of Thrones a little bit into his own research. And he talks about that toward the end of our interview. I love this interview. I couldn't wait to put this out. Without further ado, here is Dr. Gregory Webster. Greg, what makes you interested in Game of Thrones?
Game of Thrones is interesting to me because I'm kind of a fan of sci-fi, and I really read it more as potentially a sci-fi novel than a fantasy novel or series, I should say. So that's what's kind of the draw for me.
All right, tell me about this. So let's suspend an easy genre solution at this point.
All right.
And let's look at what are the guiding principles of science fiction that would make you think that this particular book fits more into a sci-fi genre?
So I see sci-fi a lot of times having to do with the conflict within human nature and with second conflict between human nature kind of as a whole and some other outside force or entity.
Mm.
And so it's basically a lot of sci-fi is there's some sort of outside force or entity, maybe it's aliens or something like that. And there's a conflict between humans or humanity as a whole and this other force. But then within humanity, there's also this kind of conflict going on between, well, how do we deal with this and how do we approach this? How do we change? Do we stay the same? It becomes kind of a social dilemma in a way.
Mm-hmm. And there are certain staples to sci-fi that we don't find in this series, but there are certain things like the little bit of time manipulation.
I try to interpret A Song of Ice and Fire, the series, as being just the largest work in George R. R. Martin's long repertoire of mostly science fiction / horror.
Yeah.
So he comes from that background. Everything he's written up until this point, for the most part, has been in that realm. And so I think what he's doing on a whole is he's critiquing fantasy in a way and kind of having some fun with a lot of fantasy tropes about the pauper marries the princess and then they live happily ever after or whatever, and saying, well, that never actually happens. And, you know, it could be that this is really just one big science fiction type thing where there's, for whatever reason on this particular world or planet, They seem to be stuck in some sort of feudalistic medieval situation.
I think that Martin likes to play with hybrids. Mm-hmm. And I think that, like, even his concept of like a werewolf or what a dwarf is like, or what a tree spirit ought to look like, I think these are all hybrids. And I think that maybe the genre question could be thought of in those terms as well. Mm-hmm. So I think it would perfectly work with this theory that Martin has hybridized sci-fi and fantasy.
Yeah.
But kind of disguised it as fantasy. What do you think about that?
Oh, I think that's probably what's going on. I think that there's, you know, it's definitely a fantasy series on the surface level. I think that, but in the background, I think there's some sci-fi going on there.
So, yeah. Greg, with these podcasts, what I'll do is I'll do a synopsis of the chapter. Mm-hmm. But this is a overall view. So what I'm going to try to do, and who knows how well I'll be able to do this, but I'd like to do a synopsis of the first 9 chapters. Mm-hmm. And so I'll try to do this in a single paragraph. And then if you're up for it, I'd like us to sort of take a deep dive into a few different characters. And I'd like to get your particular expertise on a few of these key characters and talk about maybe some of the undergirding motivations.
All right.
All right, so here's my synopsis. After a member of the Night's Watch encounters a White Walker, he flees south, only to be executed by Ned Stark. We meet the Starks and the people in their orbit. We meet Ned, who grieves the passing of his surrogate father and laments his choice to become King Robert's right-hand man. We meet Catelyn, who pushes Ned to his southern duties and out of Winterfell. We meet Jon, who represents a constant discomfort for Catelyn, and who is suffering for it. We meet Arya, who's chafing with gender expectations. We meet Tyrion, who is bright, curious, but wounded. We meet a young Bran, who is driven by his life as an able-bodied climber. We also learn that Jon Arryn may have been murdered. When Bran discovers the twincest of Jaime and Cersei, Jaime tries to kill him. Meanwhile, in Essos, Daenerys Targaryen has been traded for the promise of an army by her brother. She is the child bride of the warlord Drogo and is learning to negotiate a new culture and her own enslavement. How did I do?
That's really excellent. That's got to be so hard to do, to summarize all of that in one paragraph. So my hat's off to you.
It's probably 4 paragraphs pressed together. But I think that in these first 9 chapters, we've been introduced to a lot of the key characters, especially in the North. Mm-hmm. Going to eventually disperse and wander around and get in adventures. And then through their adventures and their eyes, we'll be introduced to Martin's world from each viewpoint.
Yeah.
Okay. So, Greg, I'm just going to ask you about a couple of characters here. And I'd like to hear, as someone who teaches psychology, some of your take on their character arcs. Mm-hmm. And we don't have to limit ourselves to this particular book and have a view to the larger series. But let's go ahead and start with Arya. And I'm thinking about specifically her in the House of Black and White, where, and we see this in several different religions, that in order to, I don't know, achieve higher enlightenment, you cast off ego.
Yes.
And that's very much what is expected of her in the House of Black and White, where she has to become no one. Mm-hmm. And there's something about that where
she, yeah, it's a very, yeah, Eastern kind of loss of self.
Yes.
Idea. Yeah.
She's not, I don't think she's actually able to do it. And I guess the question.
I don't think she does ultimately.
Right. And I think part of what keeps her ego intact is this vengeance list, this kill.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah.
And she decides that she's going to use it as her almost evening prayers. Mm-hmm. It's like her own personal religion, her evening prayers. And it doesn't just remind her of the people she wants to kill. It kind of reminds her of her own identity.
Yeah, I think that's interesting because it's almost like her identity is basically wrapped up in this kind of higher purpose in a way. This idea of revenge or vengeance and getting back at all the people who have either wronged her or people she's loved over time. And even though she's changing as a person and growing over time, she kind of maintains that thread throughout all these different identities of getting revenge on
yeah.
these people. She believed is wronged her, or who actually have.
So this character that I'm going to bring up, Sandor Clegane, the Hound, he kind of couples with Arya for a time and becomes something of a mentor to her, I suppose.
Yeah, that's some of my favorite parts of the series. Yes. And actually the television show too, which, you know, has its ups and downs, but I think that's some of the best writing both in the book and in the TV series.
I have a question for a psychology professor on the Hound.
And yeah.
I know you've done a little bit of work with genetics relative to your other interests. Here's my question. We have this expression, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, which is kind of folk wisdom.
Right.
I wonder how much someone like the Hound, his motives and actions are predetermined either by his genetics or his upbringing or something like that. He's certainly a man of violence, mm-hmm. and he's tortured, but he's, in many ways, he's very honest about it. He's, you know, that he is a man of violence and he doesn't apologize for it. But I wonder how much choice he actually has in this and how much of a character like the Hound has been predetermined by either genetics or upbringing.
That's a really good question. So the whole, gene versus environment debate is an ongoing thing in a lot of, you know, social and biological sciences. But it's, I think the one thing that most people would agree on is that it's a dynamic interaction between both of those things that unfolds over developmental time. And so even though there is some evidence of heritability of personality traits, mm-hmm. and so that's been gleaned from things like twin studies that have, you know, compared monozygotic and dizygotic twins or identical and fraternal twins. And so we know that there's personality traits are at least partially heritable, which would imply that there's some genetic component. People's tendency towards aggression or their aggressiveness can be considered a personality trait, and it's at least partly heritable. However, your environment probably has a much larger role in influencing the extent to which you'll actually express that aggression or violent tendencies over time. So if you took the Hound at birth and fostered him at, I don't know, someplace where, I don't know, there's very little violence, I think he'd be... You know, he'd still grow up to be larger than normal, so he could still, you know, use violence to his advantage in some situations. But I don't think he would be nearly as violent. Or if maybe his older brother, Gregor, was not as violent or hadn't, you know, allegedly put his face in a brazier when he was young.
Yeah.
You know, maybe he would have turned out quite different, right? So a lot of it just has to do with how you're raised and, you know, what kind of environment you're exposed to, especially during your main developmental years, say between, you know, birth and pubescence.
Well, we know that at particular stages of childhood development, a sense of fairness is really important. It's almost paramount. Mm-hmm. And both Arya and the Hound experience an extreme form of injustice at a very early age.
Yeah.
So with the Hound, you know, he's out of no fault of his own, his brother just decides to put his face in the fire. And then he experiences his father really not punishing and in fact making up this alternative story. So that there's a extreme injustice that really impacts his character. And Arya experiences both the death of the butcher's boy and the death of her father for what she perceives to be a severe injustice. And so for Arya in particular, but maybe the Hound also, their sense of vengeance is an outworking of this seminal injustice they've experienced.
Yeah. So I think maybe they're kind of going on their own respective quests for justice in some way and, you know, trying to find peace through that. But I think one of the overarching themes of the series is that revenge, even though it's fun to write about, only causes more misery for most characters most of the time. Hmm. It only serves as, you know, an accelerant and basically just causing everyone more woe. Hmm. I mean, I often view Martin's works having this pretty strong anti-war, peacenik kind of themes to them.
Really?
So, yeah, I think, and this is, I think, one area in which the television show and the book series diverge, in that part of HBO's goal to get readers is it's got to show, you know, a lot of blood and guts and warfare and so on. And I think in doing so, sometimes it misses the point in that it glorifies warfare and violence. Whereas in the book, I think almost every time you see violence or warfare, it's basically kind of a critique of human nature and showing just how stupid and senseless and pointless violence and warfare is, because it only ends up kind of bringing people ultimately, you know, more misery. And I think the same goes for revenge and ideas of vengeance. And I think one of the main themes of the book is trying to discern if there is a dividing line between justice and vengeance. And I think it turns out that it all ends up being in the eye of the beholder in terms of what people's goals and motivations are. Hmm. Right. So, and there is no true dividing line. You can't really have really good justice where everyone's satisfied and all the wrongs are righted again. That world simply doesn't exist.
Okay, let me ask you this, because, and it could be that I've misconstrued some of what you said, but it's got me thinking about Ned Stark's character. Mm-hmm. Because I think in many ways, well, if what you just said is right, and I have this inclination to align with what you've just said about Martin's critique of war, then I think a lot of fans have misread these characters and this story. Because I get the sense from a lot of fan discussion that the smarter characters are the characters that are the most ruthless. And in this case, the Lannisters maybe are better at this, or Littlefinger is better at this than someone like Ned Stark. But I wonder if Martin is trying to critique these very human but futile attempts at grabbing power through violent means. I wonder if a character like Ned, who is in all, in, you know, he's at least he's trying his best to be a good lord, or to be a good knight, or to be a good soldier, or something like that, be a good hand of the king. Is he a flawed character?
No, I think he's a flawed character. So I don't think there, I don't even know if there are any ideal characters in this book or in the series. I think he's a flawed character, you know, in many ways. So he's got such a stick up his ass about being dutiful.
Yes.
That he ends up kind of plunging the whole realm into a war that, not necessarily avoidable, but it could have, he had several opportunities to potentially save a lot of lives. So he's, you know, time and again, I think, sacrificing the greater good to preserve his own duty, to try to be this like honest, nice guy. But, you know, at the end, you can't be that person and be a successful or good hand of the king in a way.
Let me, and, I, you know, at times I feel like I totally agree with you, but I'm going to push back a little bit just to see where the conversation goes.
All right.
What if I were to say, no, Ned has it right. Ned, to live an honorable life and to be remembered as an honorable person is much more valuable than surviving a few more years and having history remember you as, you know, the guy that did what was politically expedient. I think maybe if the goal is to just live a few more years, that's a very individualistic way to look at this story. But if Ned is trying to do right by his ancestors and to do his best to bring honor to his tribe, then maybe he's the character that wins.
Yeah, I think that's kind of the, in this series, is one of the roots of all evil, is kind of this idea of in-group favoritism, of kind of being loyal to your own tribe or family or house or whatever.
No one does that better than the Starks, right?
Or yeah, that ends up translating into kind of outgroup bias or outgroup prejudice and warfare. So if every house is always loyal to itself, that ends up kind of breeding competition in a way. Yeah. And if everyone's loyal to themselves or to their own group, then that's going to lead to conflict. And I think that
would be the overall critique of collectivism, right? I mean,
yeah, in some ways. Yeah.
Because it's based on this in-group, out-group
dynamic.
Yeah.
I think, you know, one of the things that struck me when reading Game of Thrones for a second time was if we go back to the Hound killing the butcher's boy, and, you know, Arya complains to Ned about this, and Ned does virtually nothing, right? He doesn't, he's just like, oh, I'm sorry, I don't even know if he said that, but he's just kind of like, yeah, sorry, your friend was killed. You know, a few chapters later, Robert Baratheon wants to, you know, kill Daenerys Targaryen, and he's like, whoa, hold on. Right. You know, he's even goes so far as to resign his position or offer his resignation as Hand of the King. And that's probably only because Daenerys is probably a relative of his, and he probably knows that.
Or it's a class thing, you know.
Yeah, that could also be it. Yeah, where she's important, whereas the butcher's boy is not. And I think a lot of people get lulled into this false sense that, you know, Ned cares for the children. He's always, you know, putting the children first. He didn't give, you know, 2 cents or two, you know, he didn't give anything about the butcher's boy.
Right.
So I think he's also kind of a little bit too, you know, part of duty and honor is kind of sticking to the rules. And sometimes those rules or laws might be in and of themselves unjust, mm-hmm. right? So then you get into the conflict between human ethics and the ethics of, you know, law or society. And when those two things are in conflict, which do you choose? And Ned tends to choose, I think, you know, the law of the land.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think to support your view of Ned, to undermine my suggestion, if you look at what happens to Winterfell as the consequence of what Ned does, or the inactions that Ned takes, he does not leave his tribe in a very good position politically.
Right.
So if we're judging this by the outcome, what we might call consequentialism from a philosophical point of view, if we judge this by the amount of good that is brought to the realm, then Ned is a failure. Mm-hmm. Because his own tribe is torn up and Winterfell is burned down and all of this business happens.
Yeah, there's so many things he could have done in terms of counterfactual thinking, in terms of choices he made, like, you know, he could have said no to going south with King Robert. I don't know how that would have turned out if you say no to the king. Or if he just, you know, when he's sitting on the throne as Hand of the King, when Robert's alive but still injured, he basically listens to these pleas from the Riverlands that are allegedly getting raided by the Mountain. And he immediately just says to Beric Dondarrion, form up this group of riders and go out and take care of this. And that's, you know, one of the things that ends up starting the War of Five Kings. You know, maybe if he had been a little bit, I don't know, wiser, maybe seen through that, or I don't know. He's just kind of a black and white, right or wrong kind of thinker.
Maybe that works better as, I'm thinking about if he had stayed in the North, let's just imagine a scenario. Yeah. Ned Stark stays in the North. He doesn't become a Hand of the King. He stays in the North and he just keeps on going business as usual, which was his inclination, by the way. That's what he wanted to do.
Yep.
And, you know, maybe he fares pretty well as the Warden of the North. And maybe it's just the job description that he's not suited for. I really do want to push back against this Ned being unwise. I think early in the story, he's portrayed as a very wise father figure, mm-hmm. but someone who is, he's almost, are you familiar with the Peter Principle?
No.
Okay. The Peter Principle, and I'll probably butcher it, but the Peter Principle is that if you do really well at your job, you'll probably get promoted and you may not be well suited for the next job description to which you're promoted. Mm-hmm. And so the job, if you do well, you'll probably earn your way out of the job that suited you. And then you'll stop being promoted at the next level, at some point at the next level, because you're not well suited for the job you're in. It's almost like Ned does really well as a soldier, as a warden of the North, and he gets promoted, and he gets promoted to a job that he's really not good at.
Right. Yeah. I shouldn't say it's not so much he's making unwise decisions. It's more like he's kind of a fish out of water, and he's over his head, and he's dealing with these political backstabbers now, which he hadn't, you know, had to deal with as simply the head of House Stark and Warden of the North. So I think it's just is this, you know, weird kind of mismatch. But I mean, it's not like things at Winterfell are necessarily perfect. I mean, we know, unlike the show, in the book, Ned and his brother never speak when his brother comes home from the Night's Watch to attend that the Harvest Festival. In fact, they have to speak through Maester Luwin. So it's almost like there's this some sort of sibling thing that happened at some point where they stopped talking to each other.
You know, that's really interesting.
It only comes down as a common courtesy because the king's there. So I think that at some point in the past, they must have had some sort of huge argument or something to the point where they won't even talk to one another. And that also, you know, makes me wonder why is Benjen so messing with Jon Snow to try to get him to join the watch? And then when he gets there, it's just kind of like, well, thanks for joining. I'm heading north of the wall now. Good luck. It's just, there's a weird family dynamic going on there.
Well, okay, so that's interesting. So I'd never given this any thought before, but you're right that in these early chapters, we never see a conversation between Benjen and Ned.
Yeah, they're not backslapping each other. They don't even talk to one another. And you know that Benjen's been up at the wall for years and years and years, and probably only visits on these, you know, special occasions, if that. So it's what was the falling out between them?
Huh.
Did it have to do with these, you know, larger things you learn about later on, like with Lyanna or who Lyanna's child or children are, all that stuff?
You know, that's interesting. I wonder, so I've been thinking about this for a grand total of 30 seconds, so who knows if it's right or not. But we know that Ned was fostered at the Eyrie.
Yep.
Robert is much more of a brother than his natural born brothers. And it could be that he just doesn't have that sense of camaraderie with Benjen that he doesn't have the history with him.
Yeah,
that's interesting. All right, I'm gonna ask you a question, and you can choose to answer it however you want. All right. Of all the characters in all of all the series, the character that your friends and family think you are, but the character that deep down inside you know you really are.
Wow. I would say I think most people would maybe see me as probably Maester Marwyn.
Oh, really? All right. Remind us about Maester Marwyn, because he's actually kind of a character of intrigue.
Yeah. So I don't resemble him in terms of his physical description, because he's kind of this like ham-fisted, really strong and brusque maester, which is kind of unusual for a maester. But I think I'm similar to him, or people would see me as similar to him, in terms of the fact that he's traveled the world. And so I guess compared to most people in my family and social network, I've done a lot more traveling.
Marwyn's a little bit like the Indiana Jones of the Maesters.
Yes. Yeah, that's a good way to kind of summarize his character. So he's been all over the place, and he's also befriended people from all levels of society. And so That's kind of how I think people see me as being as well. So I don't really fit into like one particular social clique. I have friends from all different walks of life, from all over the place, from all different backgrounds. And I like reading, and I like mystery. And he seems to be, you know, just really interested in things related to the occult, which I think most of that stuff is baloney, but it's interesting to read about.
Yeah, so, he's not closed-minded as some of these other maesters, in that they've already made up their mind about the way that the world works, whereas Marwyn is kind of open to some of the weirder stuff people are talking about.
Yeah, so he's very open-minded, I would say, and willing to indulge in these kind of strange ideas and to travel to strange places.
Okay, so that's what people think you are.
I think inside I'm probably an even more obscure character. I'm probably more like Roderick the Reader. who's basically just, especially right now, I'm just kind of holed up in my condo here with a lot of good books, just trying to read them all and anxiously anticipating new books from my favorite authors to come out.
All right. So something that you've written recently, something that you've read recently.
Well, something I'm working on right now is in the fall, I collected a bunch of data on how people perceive the personality traits of characters in A Song of Ice and Fire, both in terms of the TV show and the books. I got people to fill out this survey from three different subreddits that relate to A Song of Ice and Fire. And I recently gave a talk back in February on the findings from that research. And it's really interesting because I ended up basically asking people to rate basically every major character in terms of these nine personality traits. And I'm going to be sharing the results of that study on the three subreddits where I collected the data in the coming days or weeks.
By the time this particular podcast drops, it will be published in that case. How will it?
So people can go to the three subreddits where I collected data are the Game of Thrones subreddit, which mostly is geared towards the TV show.
Yeah.
There's A Song of Ice and Fire, or the acronym thereof, there's that website. And then there's Pure A Song of Ice and Fire, which is mostly for book readers and is a much smaller subreddit. And their tagline is "We do not show," so they don't really welcome show discussions on there. But anyway, I'll be posting the results to all three of those, and basically you can get see how your views of a character's personality match up with the average reader's or viewer's personality of a given character. And we rate them on both kind of positive traits and on negative traits. One of the things I'm interested in on a psychological level is looking at the extent to which people project their own personalities onto characters. So I had people rate their personalities in addition to their characters. And people do statistically significantly project their own personalities onto other characters. In other words, let's say that you're high on extroversion. Let's say you're a super extrovert, you're more likely to see characters across the board on average is more extroverted than other people on average. Same goes for, let's say that you're highly Machiavellian. In other words, you really like to manipulate people, or at least that's how you would describe yourself. You're more likely to see other characters as more Machiavellian than the average person. And I'm particularly interested in some of these like darker traits, so-called darker traits like Machiavellianism. And as you might imagine, you know, some of those Machiavellian characters are characters like Littlefinger and Varys and so on. So generally people gave character ratings in the same ways that you might expect. In fact, the other question that I'm interested in as a psychologist is the degree of consensus. In other words, are different people viewing characters in more or less the same way? And on average, that was also the case, and for the most part, significantly so. And that's just, you know, the sign of a good author in a way, right? So an author's job in a way is to kind of give you an impression of a character's personality traits. And the way they do that is by making them say certain things or do certain actions that relate back to that trait in some way. So in other words, you're able to kind of glean a person or a character's underlying personality trait by these little tidbits that the author's leaving you. And in general, people form consensus that's pretty consistent across these character traits.
Well, and I wonder if, I mean, how does that relate to just the construction of empathy? I mean, if you think of a character that people really like a lot, like Tyrion or Arya or Sam Tarly or something like that, if the author's doing his job, then these characters that are driving the narrative are characters we relate to. There's something about that process wherein either we want to find ourselves in that character, or we want that character to express things of our idealized self. Like we like it when Tyrion says the witty things that that we wish we would have said. So we almost become intertwined with these characters in a few ways. I don't know. What do you think about that?
That's a really good point. I hadn't really gotten into the kind of the extent to which people empathize with the characters on that level, and whether or not they really want to see themselves in the characters. And, you know, does it depend on whether they view the character as a, you know, quote unquote good guy or quote unquote bad guy, even though, as we all know in the books, they're almost all characters are various shades of gray. But that's a really good question. That's something I should probably follow up with in the future, is looking at this as kind of the degree of to which people empathize or don't empathize with a certain character's plight and so on.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
Apes hunt humans.
That is wrong.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
And now Steve and I talk about Ned's choices, dog breeds, the Rocky franchise, and Steve insults the city of Philadelphia. Steve, we're wrapping up season one.
Here we are.
Batman's dead.
Batman is dead.
We saw nudity and dragons in the same scene.
Yeah, well, that's good for everybody, I guess.
It really gives almost everyone something to enjoy.
Right. And again, I mean, it's that little balm that heals the wounds from Ned's beheading, right?
Yeah, so, who cares that Ned died?
Everybody's just like reeling. I can't believe it. I mean, right out the gate. Ooh, look at that.
So here's what we're going to do. We're going to do a little bit of listener feedback, and then we're going to play one of the Game of Thrones favorite games, and that is, what should Ned have done differently? I think I've got a different take on this than most people, but all right, so we'll tease that at the end of the episode, and end of the wrap-up pod, or whatever we're calling this. Okay, let's get to some listener feedback. Do you want me to go first, or you want to go first, Steve?
You go first.
All right, this is from Sandra in Austin.
Hello, Sandra. Thank you for your correspondence.
Yeah. It's either Sandra or Sandra, and I know it probably makes a difference, and I just
don't know. Yeah, well, so let's try that again. Hello, Sandra. Thank you for your correspondence. So you can just, once you find out, you can just pick whichever pronunciation I did correctly.
Yeah. This is from Sandra in Houston. She says, in your book, you suggest that Miri Mazdoor is something of a third-wave feminist champion and that she is justified in betraying Dany. In your view, does this make Dany an antagonist or an anti-hero? All right, so I do give a couple different categories for trying to understand Miri Mazdoor. I think one thing that Aaron and I say is that maybe she's a trickster. It's like, the god Loki is a trickster.
And to be clear, this is like that tribal Rizzo.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
Yeah, there you go. And the other thing that we say is that maybe if we're looking at the story with modern eyes, Miri is maybe modern or advanced or truer feminist than Dany is. Because she's ready to burn the whole thing down. She's like, look, your son was going to be the stallion that mounts the world. That sounds pretty bad for people like me.
It depends if you're the stallion.
Right, so yeah.
It's all good perspective.
Good for the stallion. bad for the world. Yeah, bad for the world. So
like, it's all about location.
It's all about location. So if you live in the world, maybe the stallion who mounts the world is not a great idea. And in this case, maybe Miri Mazdoor does everyone a favor by essentially tricking Danny and getting rid of the fetus, the weird half-dragon fetus or whatever. And
I'm your fetus. I'm on fire with your desire.
That actually really works well for this Targaryen baby.
I'm working on an entire parody song for this.
New theme for season two. It's just Steve and I doing parody songs of all of our favorite 80s hits.
Right, yeah. And of course, there will be Cruel Winter, the Bananarama jam that's going to be coming.
Right. You know, Pyromancer, Arson for Money, that kind of thing.
Be your Pyromancer. Romancer of Pyro. I'm into it.
All right. So does this make Danny an antagonist or an anti-hero? I'm not sure if either of those, I don't think I'd use either of those categories. Sandy. Sandra D. I think Danny is sometimes a good guy and sometimes she's a bad guy. And I think that a lot of characters, you could say the same thing for a lot of characters in this show. At different points, they're going to be good guys or bad guys. And it will depend on perspective, and it will depend on where they are in the narrative, because Martin likes to create these moral forks where you only have two bad answers, and you have to choose the least bad of the two answers. So I don't think she's an anti-hero. I think an anti-hero is someone who's sort of a bad guy that you have empathy with. Like maybe the Hound or something. Maybe Jamie would be more of an anti-hero. I think that Danny in this case is heroic at many points in this first season. And then when she burns Miri Mazdoor alive, she's probably not heroic. something other than heroic. I don't know. I mean,
unless, you know, you prevent one stallion from mounting the world, and it's like, and then you go, well, this person, you know, maybe on some level, the world needs to be mounted. And Danny's like, if we start wiping out every potential stallion that's going to mount the world, we might wipe out the good stallion that's a little more gentler in its mounting. And then if somebody like Miri Mazdoor is just out there willy nilly killing fillies, then we've got to, we've got to fix that.
I think most stallions view the world as a place without necessary structure, or at least it's not structured the way that they want it. And they think, okay, let's mount this thing to fix it. And
yeah, I mean,
and
I
it
guess
could be I, that, and yeah. I think that justifies a lot of Philly willy nilly.
Well, but if we put it in perspective, let's say like the Italian stallion, right? So the Italian stallion, you know, Pauly was very upset when the Italian stallion and his sister Adrian had relations, right? But as we learned through the narrative, how important that relationship was. So, I mean, if you look at it in a vacuum, right? If you look at it just at that moment, you know, if it were up to Pauly at that moment, he would have certainly burned everything down like a Miri Mazdoor. But like, fortunately, cooler heads prevailed, right? So, I mean, we just don't know. We'll never know if Miri Mazdoor was really going to be the Pauly in this particular story.
I think you're right about that.
Like, and if she had spent more time, whenever, like, Danny would, like, say she's going to do something, go, what are you, crazy? And then I think people would have been like, oh, okay, that's, you know, I mean, she's asking the right questions. You know, there's a certain whimsy and there's a lot of spittle. Like, I mean, I think there's that grounds it a little bit. Like, you know, it's about approach, I think.
Rocky, the original Rocky, very underrated love story.
You know, it's funny that you mentioned that. I've actually had an ongoing argument with a friend of mine who insists that I am wrong, that it's a love story. And I said, well, I mean, you can take my word for it, or you can listen to Stallone when he speaks of it as being a love story that he wrote.
I think it's a love story. I think it's a love story in a few levels. I think it's a love story between Adrian and Rocky, of course.
Sure.
I think it's also sort of almost a love letter to the city of Philadelphia.
Okay.
So I think that there's something of a love affair between, really, you know, Rocky is something of an avatar for a certain moment in time for that city.
Sure. Philadelphia's not smart. That's fine. Keep going.
I don't know about that, man. Some of those turtle jokes that Rocky makes,
that's true.
Pretty clever.
Yeah, you know what? Fix your bell, folks, all right?
And as far as a sports story goes...
I can't wait for the next letters from the fans. Sandy from Philadelphia, what's the matter, you? You know, I can't wait for this whole thing.
No, they will not send letters, Steve. You will you will be murdered. That's
yeah, I'm going to get batteries thrown at me at work.
And as far as it being like a sports story...
I love Philadelphia. I've never been there, and I can't wait to go.
Also a love story between Rocky and the thumbs of gamblers. He refuses to break the thumbs,
yeah,
Steve.
Yeah. Well, and the love story just keeps perpetuating, even though it becomes much more boxing-centric. By the time you get to four, when Polly falls in love with his robot.
Oh, the robot. I'll be honest, man. When I first saw that in the theater, I thought that robot was the coolest thing I'd ever seen in my life.
Sure, and so did Polly. Polly, give Polly credit. He also became this hacker. Like, he reprogrammed this robot to be a woman.
Very, yeah, very which is underrated narrative arc with Polly. Very yeah, underrated.
Like, so Polly is a genius, but he has to find the proper motivation. And if it comes to the point where he's like, maybe I could have sex with this robot. Like, suddenly then he goes full on Good Will Hunting and just rewires it.
It's the inspiration he needed. You know, oddly, Steve, the rest of our questions all relate to Rocky, the Rocky franchise, and some of the non-canonical Rocky material, some of the fan theories.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know. That makes sense.
All right, this is a question for you, Steve, and this is
okay.
This is the favorite.
Wait, what's your problem?
This is my favorite question we got. Robbie from Grand Rapids asks, Steve, so far in the short run of this podcast, you've admitted to drowning a puppy and pretending to be friends with people while you gossip behind their backs. In addition, you claim to have rewatched the Joffrey slap scene several times. Are you a sadist? Or, these are your two options, or... Is sadism your stage persona?
Oh, wow. Okay. That's incredible. It's, you know, Robbie, you've given me a lot to think about. And I appreciate you challenging me to really do a little bit of, you know, internal inventory. I don't consider myself a sadist. Now, to be clear, the dog lived. All right. And I believe I thought I was helping. I look back now.
That puppy was going to grow up to be Hitler.
We just don't know. We just don't know. I'm the Miriam Asgur in this situation.
You absolutely are, for sure.
Yeah, and that ended up being the retriever mix that mounted the world. And I hope you're all happy that my mom saved it. No, I'm not a perfect person. to be clear, let's take each one of these things on its own, right?
Let's boil this down. You only have two options, Steve. You're either a sadist or is sadism your stage persona?
Well, here's the thing. This is where you've set yourself in a very interesting situation. This may be a Schrodinger's cat type situation, right? If I say that sadism is my stage persona, then I've revealed that I'm not a sadist, right? But that could be part of my sadistic nature. If I say that I'm a sadist, I have to say it. If I am a sadist, I have to question whether or not I want to admit it. And then if I say I'm a sadist, that could still be me doing my stage persona, because this is the medium in which we're interacting. We're not having, you know, I made no eye contact with you, Robbie. I don't even know if that's your real name. So I don't know if Robbie is your stage persona. What you've done is you've created a scenario that is very fascinating. And it's almost impossible for me to answer truthfully because the truth will also be considered false.
Isn't Andrew Dice Clay, I mean, I think he's the example. He was a sadist as his stage persona.
Mm-hmm.
But there's got to be part of him that is that person.
Sure. And I think there's also a certain sadistic quality, especially if you know that there are people that don't like this stage persona. The sadist, the true sadist inside, gets to amplify this sort of mock sadism to create true sadism.
Wow, man. Robbie, you've given us just a really rich conversation topic, and I want to thank you.
Yeah, and I'm a very gentle person. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean I'm not sadistic. It just means that there's a certain slowness to it.
Steve Osborne, the gentle sadist.
Wow. Okay, I got to go work on my bio.
Okay, this is for me. Nick in Natal, Brazil. So Nick from Natal. If you could pick one piece of Game of Thrones memorabilia from the show, what would it be? I'm not a big memorabilia guy, Nick.
Really?
Yeah, not really. Because
I guess not. I don't know if I've ever seen you with a tchotchke or anything.
No. I wouldn't go out of my way for memorabilia. You know what I would like though? I like art and I like illustration. And if I could have some storyboards, you know, like an artistic rendering.
Like a flannel graph from Sunday school?
Yes.
A Game of Thrones flannel graph?
I would like a flannel graph of Miri Mazdur.
You realize I just made us $1 million. You're going to want to edit this out of the podcast because anybody else that hears this is going to immediately run and make a flannel graph for
Game of Thrones. Tiny little half-dragon baby.
Oh, man. Okay.
You know, with maggots and it goes in and out of the wigwam.
Just a whole flannel graph. Like, we can make, I mean, why aren't we making flannel graph for everything? Lost Boys flannel graph.
Man, this is a
Golden Girls flannel graph.
Nick, again.
Thank you.
Thank you, Nick. Thank you, Nick. Yeah, some storyboards would be fun. I'd have them framed. I'd put them up. That would be super fun.
That would be cool. I could see you. Yeah, you're more of a, the idea of memorabilia, right? Like, I guess the thought behind it is, one is there's a nostalgia factor. It sort of connects you to the fiction in sort of a more tangible way, right? Like we have I have a Kill Bill, like a mock Kill Bill sword.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah.
You've got the Hattori Hanzo?
I have a mock Hattori Hanzo that it's Bud sword with the full.
Oh,
with the,
so this is not the sword that if you meet God along the road, God right, will right, be right, cut. Right. That's not,
no, this is, but this has the, it has the inscription from Bill to Bud.
Oh, right, right. Good. I like that idea.
But it's sitting in my closet. It's not like it's on display.
See, that's the thing about memorabilia. I do have one little bit of memorabilia, Steve.
Yeah.
I think it's the only thing I have. I've got a trailer reel, like the actual, it's an actual reel in a little, you know, movie tin or whatever. Of the trailer for Star Wars. And I like having it. I looked it up on eBay to see if I could sell it once, and it's really not worth that much money. And I can't watch it. I don't have a reel-to-reel movie projector. So it does me no good at all.
Yeah.
No, but what about you? If you could have a piece of memorabilia from the show, is
Ned's
that something
head.
You'd want? You want Ned's head.
Yeah, and I want it out in my front yard on a spike.
Wow. Yeah, because you know that they had to create... You're not actually saying you want Sean Bean to be beheaded.
No, but I mean, well, okay.
I mean, it would have a different sort of value.
Maybe let me get into my stage persona.
All right. Another question for you.
Sure.
This is from Ian in Hamburg. And I'm assuming this is Hamburg, Germany, because I don't know of any other Hamburgs. I'm sure that there are. My son-in-law, 19 years old, is a big stand-up comedy nerd. Mm. He moved to Sausalito near SF just before COVID, and hasn't been able to see any performances yet. But once comedians are performing again, which venues would you recommend? Feel free to mention your own shows. That's really right. Kind of Ian.
That is very kind.
Allow you to promote.
That is very kind. I would say, I mean, if it's Sausalito, I mean, obviously there's a lot of great, like if everything, let's just say everything opens up and everything's fine. Of course, you're going to want to go to the Punchline and Cobb's in San Francisco. And I think it's going to be even, it has the potential to be even more special when everything reopens, because I think you're going to see talent that might be doing bigger shows, doing some of these smaller venues. So you may have an opportunity to see some acts that you might not normally see there. Also, they may be bringing like features that are really special as well, that are headline quality. But then assuming that these places come back, there's a lot of places that I don't know if they're going to come back, right? Like a lot of these littler spots, like I would have said Starline Social Club in Oakland is fantastic, but I think I heard that they might be closing. I don't quote me on that, but same thing with, and like then the Setup is a fantastic little basement show. And again, but that's going to be a tough one because it's so small and I don't know what social distancing.
That's called the Setup. Where's that located?
It's below a tavern. But like if you look it up, Setup Comedy Club, like it actually has it. Like they've done a really good job of creating.
Is that in Oakland or
San Francisco? They treat it like a real comedy club. So the Setup is kind of its own entity. I'm hoping that all these things survive. Currently you can go to the North Bay and there are some good outdoor shows. I have a show in Healdsburg that's a kind of a quasi-monthly. It's just we're kind of waiting to see what things turn out with curfew and everything, but that's at Coyote Sonoma. That's an outdoor show.
What's that show called, or does it have a name?
It's called the Comedy Roundabout.
All right, and you are also affiliated with Cobb's, right?
Yeah, Cobb's and Punchline, sure.
Okay, and those are both in the city.
Yes.
All right. Well, Nick. No, that wasn't Nick. That was Ian. Ian, tell your son-in-law he's got a number of options. Fingers crossed, we can get this all going again.
Yes.
One of the rare times. Who would have thought that Dayton would be a hotter place for stand-up than San Francisco? I got to see a really great show that Chappelle put on.
Yeah, I heard about that. That was great.
Yeah, just one of the best shows I've ever, because it broke into a concert. It's like Questlove and Common, and a bunch of people were performing in addition to the stand-up. And anyway, that's not what you care about, Ian. You didn't ask me. You asked Steve. All right. This is a question for me. This is from Olivia in Saskatoon. Which Steve is in Saskatchewan. Do you know that? Do you know Saskatoon? Have you ever been to Saskatoon?
I've never been to Saskatoon. I love the idea that Saskatchewan begets Saskatoon.
Yeah, of course it does. I mean, some people would say that the people of Saskatoon are really, really the heart of Saskatchewan. How do you feel about that? Is that too bold of a statement, Steve?
Yes.
You think that I'm not doing right by the other fine folk of Saskatchewan.
Yeah, like I mean, what are the other areas within Saskatchewan that Saskatoon casts a large shadow over?
I'm telling you, there are literally millions of miles. Mostly north. All right, Olivia asks, what is one of the book? What is the one book difference or detail that you would have liked to see incorporated into the show? I'm going to go out on a limb.
More nudity.
I have a good answer to this, but I feel like it would ruin season two for Steve. So.
Oh.
What I'll do is I will I'll edit in my answer after Steve and I are done recording, and then I'll insert it so that I'm not deflowering Steve's virgin ears.
Thank you.
Yeah. Hey, y'all. It's Anthony from 1 second ago. Here's what I think. I think they could have brought Lady Stoneheart in really late in the game, like season 7 or 8.
And I think it could have been the wedge in between Brienne and Jaime. I think it would have really complicated the Jaime and Brienne relationship and maybe given Jaime a more satisfying outcome than season 8 did. I would have loved to have seen that. I think if you brought her in like season 8, that would have been a shocker. Because I think everyone who really wanted Lady Stoneheart would have already kind of thought, well, they're not going to do it. There's no way they're going to bring in a new storyline at this stage. If you brought her in really late, I think it would have shocked everybody and enhanced everyone's enjoyment of the Brienne and Jaime tension. So that's my answer.
Thank you for not being the stallion that mounts my ears.
That actually wouldn't be a bad tagline for you either.
His comedy is the stallion that mounts your ears.
I really think, you know, let's just hope that COVID dissipates and your career advances to a Netflix special.
Gentle Sadist.
That would be your first special, and then the second special would be
The Stallion That Mounts Your Ears.
Yeah. Yeah, very good.
And then and as we talked about off air, and then if I have an opportunity to make a third, it will just be a shot for shot remake of the Paul Lynde Halloween special.
All right. This is the last question. This is from Wanda in Boston. This is for you, Steve.
Oh, okay.
I live in a small apartment in the city. My husband wants to get a dog.
Oh.
He thinks that we should get a small, smart dog that we can train. I think it would be better to get a big, stupid, lazy dog that just wants to sleep all day. What would you recommend?
Well, you're in a small apartment. I'm not sure what your outdoor potty situation is like. You live in Boston, from what I gather, and so it's going to get, you're going to have cold winters. I'm going to tell you right now, I'm going to have you focus on potty. Focus on the potty situation. Uh-huh. Small dogs tend to be a little more hesitant to take to potty training, for one. They especially don't like it. They tend to not like it if it's inclement weather, cold, rainy, if you got your snow situation.
Yeah.
So that's a chore. Your big dogs tend to be a little more down for that, right? And like to the degree that your husband says, hey, let's get something dumb. Even the dumb, it tends to be like the dumber, quote, bigger dogs understand the notion of, hey, I have to go to the bathroom. I should go do that. Whereas little dogs like, I have to go to the bathroom. I hate you. And that's like, that's the only thing that they think. So I would definitely, if you have the space in the apartment, again, I don't know how big the apartment is. It sounded like it was kind of smallish. If you could find something, maybe you need something a little more mid-range, right? Like you can get a standard poodle that maybe isn't one of the large, like maybe on the smaller end, standard poodle's great dog. They're goofy. And so it's
poodle's a very smart dog.
Poodle's a very smart dog. I know this guy wants a dumb dog, but the beauty of poodles is there's a goofiness to them that almost give the illusion of dumbness.
Mm.
So that might be what you want. You want something that feigns stupidity, but deep down they know what's going on. So it's kind of like the best of both worlds, right? And they are a little more active. They're a little playful. I'm pretty pro poodle when it comes to that kind of thing. I know that poodles get a bad rap because you often see them in their continental cut, which is more of your show cut. And people go, what am I going to do with that? Well, you don't have to do that. You can teddy bear. You can do all kinds of different things with your poodle. But nothing beats a small dog. I mean, I got a small dog. You put it in a little carrier and you're walking around with it in your purse or whatever. There's something about that that does kind of tether the line between dominance and dainty.
Do people that put the dogs in the purses, do they have a little liner in the purse? Because I don't want that dog's little anus near my valuables.
Yeah, you need a piss purse. You need a purse that you don't like so much.
I see.
So, I mean, if your dog is trained, like most dogs don't want to sit in their own filth. And so, and you can diaper it up if you're really feeling it.
Oh,
I mean, okay. I'm not, I mean, there's lots of options. I get it. I mean, I understand what you're saying.
I would have liked to see some of this incorporated into the show. I would have liked to see one of the direwolves kind of
going through a heat cycle.
I want to see one of the direwolves just good for nothing, lazy dog that sleeps all day. And one of the kids is just like, why did I get the dud? This dog sucks.
That's right. Well, that's true. I remember I had a friend who had we got a dog at the Humane Society, and there was a litter of these dogs, and you know, that sort of matched what he was going for. It looked like a tough dog, and he wanted a tough dog, and so we got him, and he would feed it malt liquor, and it would not train it and blow marijuana smoke in his face, and the dog was really dumb. I know, go figure. And then one day, like this was right after graduation, another friend of ours that had graduated. He had his own like contracting business, I guess. And so yeah. He came to the house. He had been hired by his parents to do some work on like a fence or something. And he had a dog that was clearly from the same litter. And it was like, it was amazing. It followed him. It would sit and wait and it would follow all these commands. And my buddy goes,
"You mean it wasn't dumbed up on malt liquor and marijuana?"
Right. So my buddy, so I have two friends, one that owned the dog and the other one that was over visiting. And he goes, my buddy owned the dog, goes, "Oh man, I got the dumb one." And then my buddy, without missing a beat, goes, no, "Your dog got the dumb one." So good.
See, that's what should have been in the show.
That'd be great. That's perfect.
Steve, that's all for our questions.
All right. Well, I hope I've learned a lot.
Yeah, no, this is
about
really
myself.
So we're going to play a game called What Should Ned Have Done Differently? My synopsis of Ned's story arc is that he goes south with Robert to become his hand. He tries to solve the murder of John Arryn, who is something of a father figure to him. He finds out, and he also finds out that Cersei is banging her brother.
Mm-hmm.
And then he tells Cersei that he knows, thinking that Cersei's going to run, and she doesn't run. He asks Littlefinger for help to try to, not make bastard Joffrey the next king. And then he gets thrown in jail, and eventually he falsely confesses to Robert's murder, and he gets his head chopped off.
Yeah.
All right, so, Steve, here's your question. What should Ned have done differently? A, don't go south with Robert. B, don't try to solve the murder. C, don't tell Cersei you know her secret. D, don't ask Littlefinger for help. E, don't falsely confess to Robert's murder. Or F, some other option or combination of the above.
If I'm going to pick one, I'm probably going to go don't tell Cersei you know. That feels like too much too soon.
Yeah.
You know, and I think Ned operates on this, well, everybody would probably do, but like he's intelligent enough to say, well, if I knew this, I would probably do this. And so it seems a little naive.
Well, famously, he's really against murdering Dany because she's a child, and he's like,
right.
Robert, we don't murder children, all right? Wait until she grows up. She's a problem. We'll kill her when she's an adult. He doesn't like killing kids. And so famously, he tells Cersei, thinking that he can protect her children, who he thinks Robert will most certainly murder when he finds out that they're not his kids.
Right.
So he tells Cersei, thinking that she wants to protect her children.
At all costs, right?
At all costs.
Yeah.
That's right. And you're saying maybe don't make that play.
Right. It feels like it feels like that could be a play to be made later, but that he just sort of went all in on it, right? Like, I feel like he wasn't slow playing this very well. I think he kind of thought like, okay, well, I have this information. I know this. Children are at stake, blah, and like he just sort of played it out in like one linear plan,
mm-hmm.
and step by step that started to fall apart, And so he didn't have any contingencies, it seemed like, right? And so then now he gets all of that sort of snowballs to the point where he gets to this spot where he's like, all right, well, look, I either got to confess for this and hope that I get mercy, or I do. I mean, like, because at that point, like, I feel like he was dead anyway, right? Like, so it's, I know that, like, owning up to the, you know, falsely taking the blame for the death of Robert seemed like, when you look at it, you know, at the time, it's like, it's shocking he gets beheaded, but then you kind of take some time to digest it and go, I think that was happening no matter what.
I think that's my answer. I think that I would go with E, don't falsely confess. I feel like, hey, Ned, be true to yourself. You're a man of honor. Die with honor.
Mm-hmm.
Don't try to play the game too late. You know?
Yeah.
You're the kind of guy that's going to get murdered anyway.
Right.
Just be true to yourself all the way to the end. And I feel like I agree with Kat that he's got to go south. He's got to be the hand of the king, because if he's not, after he's been asked, eventually there's going to be enmity between the south and the north, and they've got to kind of try to strengthen their ties with the south.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he's got to die. I don't think that there's another option.
Right. I mean, and that's the problem, right? It's like, I think what we see is Ned becomes almost an entry point for us into the, like, oh, there's a lot going on in this game, right?
Yeah.
And a guy like Ned just might not be very long for the game, is what it looks. Because, I mean, in order for him to survive, like, you look at, like, the people that he's sort of trying to get counsel from, or not even counsel, but trying to be, like, he gets the Littlefinger situation, and then you have Cersei. These two appear to be like, they know where they, what their roles are and how to play and survive. And whereas Ned is like, well, this is the rule book. And everyone's like, get out of here with that.
Yeah, I think a lot of fans are thinking that if Ned was smarter, he would just assume that everyone in the South is his enemy.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you go in there and just assume that everyone in here would rather have you gone or dead. And then just sort of try to outgame them and outwit them, assuming that everyone's your enemy. How many people live that way in their real life? Like, how many people go into work and think, all right, these are all my enemies, and I need to get them before they get me? It's just not how people, normal people, live their lives.
Well, I feel like that was a shot at me.
It is kind of a shot at you.
I mean, I operate. All right. Who's out to get me today? How do I eliminate them? And it's not even necessarily like for my own gain. I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm trying to gain, but there's you're constantly playing defense and offense at the same time. Game of Thrones is basketball.
So you're kind of with me on this. You're thinking Ned's going to die no matter what he does.
Right. And that's why I think with the Cersei thing, if you don't play that card right away, I mean, I still think he's going to die. He's headed towards that path, but you can use that later. Again, I'm thinking more along the lines of Ned trying to be more crafty and okay, I got this bit of information. I don't want to use my leverage right away. Let me use this later because this might really come in handy. But instead, he just puts all his cards on the table because it's just like, look, guys, I know what's going on. The jig is up, right? And everybody's like, no, not, I don't think so, Broseph.
The other thing that I didn't mention that some fans like is Ned gets an offer from Renly. Renly says, look, we got to move fast. We need to declare me king, and we will unite my forces and the North against the Lannisters. And a lot of people think maybe Ned should have taken that offer. Mm. I just feel like that is so against his character.
Right.
I don't think maybe a different person might have been able to take that offer. I don't think Ned could have taken the offer.
Well, and I think going back to what I was saying, like if you don't play all those cards right away and you prolong this, it could be a period of time where he's realizing, look, this is not going to work out. Maybe I need to join forces with Renly, right? Like when there's an opportunity later, but he just went all in on what he thought was cooler heads will just prevail out of this. And a head did prevail, so to speak, but and it got cold, I suppose. And I think to your point at the end of it, just go out true to yourself, because now his legacy is like, it's all, how do your family recover from that?
Yeah. I think that if Ned had taken Renly's offer, then the fan conversation would be that this is not authentic Ned. Ned wouldn't have done it.
Sure.
You know, we'd be talking about how, you know, his character arc doesn't make sense.
Well, and that's the challenge, right? If you're viewing this, because I'm sure at least initially, right? I mean, obviously I'm, you know, living it at the moment that like in a lot of other fans were, where they're, you know, they're trying to make sense and make peace with this whole thing. And so I'm sure there's this sense of like, well, he could have done this, he could have done that. But it does seem that this was an inevitability given Ned. Like, as great as Ned may be, and as much as we may have fallen in love with him in this short period of time in terms of like his heroism and his honor, the reality is this kind of player doesn't last very long in this game.
And then and at the same time, you got someone like Sam Tarly, you know, he just kind of lucks himself into stupid situations where he survives.
Yeah, like Vern in Stand By Me, right? Like, I mean, probably should have gotten smashed by a train or beat
Verno.
Up by anything. Yeah.
Get off your knees, Verno. You got to run, man.
Man, don't. It's just a comb.
It's like, let the comb go.
But, like, he was also thinking, he was trying to think big picture. Like, well, you know, the interview.
Yeah, they're going to find the body. They're going to be heroes.
Right.
They're going to want to comb their hair before the cameras roll.
Yeah, and he, of all of them, has no hair. Essentially, he's got a buzz cut.
He was thinking for everyone else.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, Steve, I think we've definitely done some good in the world. No animals were harmed during the making of this production.
No. No, that's a pre-existing condition.
and we are now prepping for season 2, Steve. I think you're going to like it.
Well, we shall see.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim, order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar, then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live. Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
We've got lots of ongoing coverage this week, from book versus show comparisons for Hot D to the latest very special episode of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? But there are a couple of main events this week you need to know about.
Firstly, we've got a brand new commission podcast out this Tuesday covering The Raid 2, sometimes subtitled Retaliation. If you're a fan of martial arts films, this is one you don't want to miss. Iko Uwe is a rising star in the action movie world, and it's easy to see why. Join us on Tuesday as we dive into the bigger, badder sequel to The Raid, try and figure out which is better.
Then on Thursday, we're covering the season finale of Hulu's excellent period drama, Shogun. We've been waiting all season to see what Toranaga-sama's plan is, or if he even has one. It all comes down to this, and we couldn't be more excited. Join us on Thursday for what's sure to be an epic Shogun season finale podcast, and to find out if we plan to cover any related materials.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
For this week's Bird's Eye View, I'd like to revisit a point about Ned that came up in my conversation with Don Riggs a few weeks ago. This was a point about honor and morality in Tolkien's world versus the same in Martin's world. I won't argue that Ned was intentionally cribbed from Aragorn. That's not my point here. My point here is a little bit softer. And here it is. In Tolkien's world, Aragorn's lack of ambition, his desire to stay out of politics, his ability to resist the temptation of power, these things are armor for Aragorn. In at least two ways, the intention to cast off power is what ultimately makes Aragorn throne-worthy. So here are the two ways. First, Aragorn is a key member of the Fellowship, and the mission of the Fellowship is to destroy the symbol for ill-begotten power. The idea here is that destroying the One Ring would be unthinkable to Sauron, who is hell-bent on power at any price. So Aragorn's first and most important mission is to eschew power. Hey, by the way, I reject the notion that Tolkien doesn't traffic in morally gray characters. Smeagol is among the most gray characters in all of literature. And the key plot twist of The Hobbit involves a morally gray decision by the main character. So let's put that nonsense away. All right, so secondly, Aragorn has ample opportunity to take the ring for himself, but he refuses to do it. He's not opposed to the idea of kingship, but the idea of becoming king in a dirty way is repulsive to him. I'm not saying that Aragorn is above reproach, but he views the ring as a test of his character, and it's the red line he won't cross. It's like for Ned, he won't kill children. That's just the red line he won't cross. For Aragorn, it's taking the One Ring. And because he won't betray his most deeply held value, he remains true. For Tolkien, in my opinion, this is more important than Aragorn's claim, or his fancy sword, or his fancy blood. He's able to become a true king because he's proven that he can resist corruption. So in Tolkien's world, Aragorn's armor is his mastery over his own desires, his ability to cast off power, really his refusal to sully his honor. Now, so far in Martin's world, the opposite is true, all right? So we don't know how things will ultimately end, but we know that Ned and Aragorn end up with opposite fates. As many others have observed, Ned's refusal to corrupt his honor is a weakness in Martin's world. And most of the time, I think I see it this way. Someone with Aragorn's virtues wouldn't fare well in Martin's world. Okay, I think I agree with myself on this point. But I have this little Gollum Smeagol thing going on in my head on this point. Sometimes I wonder if Ned isn't a little bit more like Boromir in the end? By the way, Boromir is another wonderfully great character in Tolkien. All right, so why Boromir? Because at the end of the day, neither Boromir nor Ned could resist the dirtier way to power. Boromir goes for the ring. He thinks it's going to be for the greater good, and really he's giving in to his own desire for power, and these things are probably merged in his mind. And Ned goes for the throne. He underhandedly omits Joffrey's name from Robert's succession order. This, if it worked, would have put Ned on the throne. Both Boromir and Ned grasp power in the end as would-be stewards of the throne. Boromir as a steward, Ned as king regent. But basically, that's the same job. And both die trying. And I'm not sure if this matters, but when they look in the mirror, they are both the spitting image of Sean Bean. Hard to say what would have happened if Ned would have simply written Joffrey's name on that document. I can't imagine that any outcome would have gone well for Ned down south. But it's possible that Ned died not because he was too beholden to honor, but because in the end he couldn't hold on to his honor. And that's all for this week.